DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. On today's programme, Poland's Donald Tusk takes the political lead on Ukraine. Election shock in Romania. How did a far-right pro-Russian candidate come out top in the first round of presidential elections?
Romania is not a pro-Russian society. On the contrary, and this stance is explicable historically speaking, right? Romania is an EU member and a NATO member state. What I mean is that the society is very much Western-oriented, and still, this person won the first round of presidential elections.
And is Ireland a bulwark of European political stability, or are things actually a little more complicated than that? Those stories and more coming up on the programme. There is a leadership vacuum in Europe at the moment. Traditionally, on matters of geopolitical importance like security and defence, the leaders of France and Germany have spoken with all the authority that comes of heading up the two largest economies in the EU. Now, though, both the French and German leaders are substantially weakened. France's Emmanuel Macron will have spent a nail-biting week watching as rows over the budget threatened to topple his Prime Minister Michel Barnier, who is heading up a minority government beset by protest from the left and far right alike. Meanwhile, Germany's Olaf Scholz has committed himself to running for a second term as Chancellor, knowing that in doing so he is in effect volunteering to shoulder the responsibility of the electoral defeat that all the polls tell him at the moment is inevitable. So, in the absence of leadership from the EU's Western powerhouse and with a second Trump presidency throwing US backing into question, who will speak for Ukraine? Enter Poland's Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, who has been popping up in some unexpected places lately, a fact that has been well noted by Terry Schultz, our security correspondent, with an eye to the question of whether European leadership on Ukraine and other security issues might be about to fall to countries closer to the front line.
Nordic and Baltic governments meet frequently in a format they call the NB8, including the eight countries from Denmark across the top of Europe down to Lithuania. This week they gathered in Sweden as the NB8 Plus to include Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk. Top of their agenda, how to deal with increased aggression from Moscow and potentially decreased support from Washington. Their host, Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson, dramatically set the scene.
We are at a pivotal moment when the future is still unwritten. Before us lies historic crossroads. It is up to us to choose what path we take for our nations and for Europe. The decisions we make in these coming months will echo for generations to come. That is the situation right now.
Inviting Poland's Tusk is far more than an act of politeness. He may become the face of the Eastern Flank, a region ready to act on behalf of itself and Ukraine without the traditional EU power couple of France and Germany, which have neither been united on supporting Ukraine nor taken the lead in rallying others. Meanwhile, Poland spends more per capita on defense than any other country in NATO, and in January, Poland will take over the rotating presidency of the European Council. Retired Polish diplomat Robert Pichel believes this unique combination of factors puts Tusk in position to forge a coalition of like-minded defense-driven nations which believe that backing Kyiv is investing in their own security.
We need unity, of course, but it cannot be anymore the unity, you know, of the slowest moving kind of vessel in this convoy. The task for Tusk is tough, but I think Poland has the credibility because it's walking the walk. It's not just talking, you know, it's defense spending, it's various efforts in terms of the actual military capabilities. And it would be fantastic if that was kind of, you know, a good example.
Tusk has been sounding the part, speaking here alongside Ulf Kristersson in Sweden.
We want to act together. It's not just a slogan. We know today better than ever before that together we are much stronger. And strength, this is what we need today. Also, this readiness to demonstrate that we are determined and ready to do everything we can as a group, as a format, but also as a EU, as a NATO, to prevent ourselves from the highest risks, which is, of course, the Russian aggressive policy.
Spending more on defense per capita than the U.S. may be a useful trump card for Tusk come January, when he has to deal with another Donald, one obsessed with European defense spending, who's threatening to cut off aid to Ukraine. A letter gaining attention and signatures in foreign policy circles calls on European NATO allies and Canada to reinforce support for Kyiv without the U.S. It specifically mentions Tusk's assertive approach. Campaign co-founder Benjamin Tallis of the Berlin-based Democratic Strategy Initiative details some of the group's recommendations, also promoted by Poland.
Seize the Russian assets, extend air defense into western Ukraine and use it to cover ground troops doing non-combat tasks there. Provide Ukraine with a safe path into NATO by extending real security guarantees and stand up for ourselves. On all of those fronts, Poland has been at the forefront of developments so far.
Tusk's rise is bound to meet resistance. Robert Pichel says he's heard grumbling in Germany about Tusk daring to bypass Berlin. But he says it's time for fresh leadership and for a coalition of the willing to replace the coalition of the waiting. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
That eastern flank that Donald Tusk may very well see himself as heading suffered an alarming shock this week. As we went to studio on Thursday, Romania's constitutional court was due to debate whether to annul the first round of presidential elections held last weekend. Against all expectations, a far-right anti-NATO candidate managed to use the platform TikTok to propel himself to victory, knocking Romania's centre-left prime minister off the second round ballot in the process. The National Audiovisual Council of Romania has asked the European Commission to open an official investigation. But in the meantime, Romanian politics has been plunged into disarray ahead of parliamentary elections on December 1st and the second round presidential runoff, which was scheduled for December 8th. It is an unprecedented situation, and as such, I was incredibly grateful to be able to turn for analysis to my Romanian-born colleague, Lavinia Pitu, from DW's Programmes for Europe department.
You know, I've been living in Germany for the last 20 years or so, and last Sunday, when the first round of the presidential election took place in Romania, must have been the longest I've watched Romanian TV in, I don't know, recent memory. So it is a shock, yes, and the TikTok shock. You know, in an absurd theatre, it would be funny, but unfortunately, this is reality, and it's the reality of a EU country and a very important NATO member from a geostrategic point of view in these very turbulent times. So how it came to this, you might wonder. Well, while the establishment parties were campaigning openly and, you know, in a traditional way, TV debates, mass media presence, billboards, etc., this gentleman, his name is Călin Georgescu, a far-right nationalist, ultra-religious, anti-NATO and anti-EU, a fan of Mr. Putin and his politics, snuck silently and through the back door, I would say, into people's TikTok accounts. That's why I was saying the TikTok shock. Apparently, he used over 5,000 TikTok accounts, bots and such, in order to reach as many people as possible. And he did, because over 2 million people voted for him. He found fertile ground among media unsavvy people, people who were fed up with the establishment, people who didn't trust the mainstream parties anymore. And since I mentioned the absurd theater, Mr. Georgescu, because in the meantime people have dug into the internet and found videos of him, has come out with the most unbelievable statements like, there is no war in Ukraine, the West is fake, women who give birth to a C-cut commit a sin in front of God, COVID didn't exist, and also different anti-Semitic statements for which he was even investigated by prosecutors in 2023, and so on. And the polls have gotten it so wrong because nobody took Mr. Georgescu seriously.
Well, nobody is not taking him seriously now. He goes into the runoff presidential election on the 8th of December now as the clear front runner. Romania is a country with a very significant land border with Ukraine. It's also got a massive NATO military base there. Is it fear of involvement in the war in Ukraine that's driving the surge in support? What are the messages that are resonating?
This whole world situation in Romania's neighbourhood, but not only, is a really fertile ground for such manipulation tactics. And people are scared. And it's not about the economy specifically in Romania, because according to the World Bank, Romania has had one of the highest economic growth rates in the EU since 2010. So it's not the economy, it's the insidious manipulation. And we've seen these phenomena in other parts of the world too, with social media, with this hybrid war which is taking place on the internet and which is really very dangerous.
Are suggestions being raised that this incredibly successful TikTok campaign, including the mobilization of lots and lots of bots, that this may have been Russian funded? Is that an idea that is being circulated in Romania? And what kind of proofs are there at the moment?
The Russians have denied it, but like we've seen it in Germany, like we've seen in the US, I think it's quite possible that this was of Russian influence. Yes, especially because Mr. Georgescu is a fan of Mr. Putin and of his politics, and he wants to isolate Romania. He says that Romania doesn't need anybody. Romania doesn't need imports, doesn't need to export stuff. It's like in his vision, Romania should live totally independently, isolated from the rest of the world, which is completely absurd.
But placing its trust in Russian wisdom, I believe, was one of the quotes that I read from him.
Right, absolutely, yes.
Now, Lavinia, we've been focusing on presidential elections, but that is only one part of the story, because we have parliamentary elections on December 1st.
Right.
What kind of crossover is there likely to be between the two?
The parliamentary elections are really important because Mr. Georgescu ran as an independent candidate, so he doesn't have a party. Now, a really somber scenario would be that his voters vote for an alliance called the AUR Alliance, which is another hard right wing party, which emerged in 2019 and whose leader came in fourth at the first round of the presidential elections. So basically by December 1st, the date of the parliamentary elections, the mainstream parties should really mobilize the people to vote for their democratic future and against extremism of all sorts. And since a lot is happening on social media, I think that even influencers should take some responsibility and explain how important democracy is.
In terms of what you've witnessed, you know, this complete surprise result through what you called the TikTok back door, do you think that the Romanian elections have urgent lessons at the moment for other countries concerned about preserving their democracy?
Yes, I think that authorities, especially or particularly the intelligence, should be extremely careful about what's going on in the virtual world. And look, for instance, Romania is not a pro-Russian society. On the contrary, and this stance is explicable historically speaking, right? Romania was behind the Iron Curtain until 1989, and that was enough of a nightmare. Romania is an EU member and a NATO member state. What I mean is that the society is very much Western oriented, and still this person won the first round of presidential elections, although the society is not pro-Russian at all. It's pro-Western. Over 6 million Romanians live abroad in Western Europe, in the US and so on, and I haven't heard anybody wishing to emigrate to Russia. So I think the lesson is keep your eyes on what's going on in the virtual world, especially on social media, because apparently we live in times in which democracy must be done on the internet too.
Lavinia Peter, thank you so much for joining me. And I look forward to hearing your voice more often on the programme.
Thank you, dear Kate. Thank you so much.
Lavinia Peetu of DW's Programmes for Europe department there, which I am delighted to announce will be Inside Europe's new home in Bonn as of next year. Well, they weren't kidding when they said that 2024 was going to be a mega election year, and there is more to come in just a minute. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. The year may be drawing to a close, but it is election season for small European countries, beginning with I. Iceland goes to the polls in parliamentary elections on November 30th, more on that next week. And on Friday, November 29th, it is Ireland's turn. Now, we're recording this on Thursday, 28th of November. And with Romania's example in mind, I'm going to preface this by saying that anything is possible and no electoral outcome can be truly known until all the votes are counted. However, that being said, one of Ireland's two historic centre-right parties, Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, has led every Irish government for the past century, and I have yet to find an Irish commentator who is expecting that to change this time. So, in a world in which the political map has never looked so uncertain, why does Ireland appear to be bucking the trend? It's a question that I put to Eoghan O'Malley, Associate Professor in Political Science at Dublin City University's School of Law and Government.
The electoral system probably helps soften the kind of blows that you'd tend to have. Because a lot of people then will vote for local candidates, even if they're not wild about the party, they like the local candidate for the party, and so might vote for that. But it's mainly to do with the economy. The economy is doing pretty well. The budget is doing well. That's not to say that people are happy and just want to continue with what's happening. And so to some extent, the government is campaigning against itself and it's saying, oh, we're going to change lots of things. We'll change this and we'll do this and we'll do that, rather than defending its record of the last number of years. And so we could see in the budget that happened in October that there was a huge increase in spending and there was a lot of promises being made. And this election campaign is, to some extent, being all about those promises.
Unusually again for Europe, there is actually a pot of money there in Ireland, isn't there? Because there's been a big windfall, 14 billion euros worth of tax from Apple, thanks to a EU court ruling.
Yeah, there's that money, and that money has been spent 10 times over in promises during the election campaign. In a way, the problem is that there's too much money. It kind of has stopped forcing governments to think about how to do this. And the money itself isn't the issue, but delivery is a big problem. So the nominal spending increases in health have been off the charts. It's about three or four times what it was 20 years ago. So there's no shortage of money being put into things like the health service, yet people still complain that it's not delivering. And one of the things that is unusual in this campaign is that there hasn't been an awful lot of talk about delivery. So, you know, government can reasonably say we've spent X billion more on housing, we've spent X billion more on health, we've spent X billion more on education. Yet nobody seems terribly content with the results, and they don't seem to be good at turning that money into kind of deliverables for voters.
We haven't talked about immigration, and I'm very aware that we're sort of around about the time of the anniversary of the anti-immigrant Dublin riots in 2023. So sort of mass manifestation of dissatisfaction with immigration policy. Those concerns, were they solved? And if not, why aren't nationalist parties able to turn them into votes in the way that has happened in other European countries?
They haven't been solved, that's for sure. There's still issues with migration. And it became a big issue in the local and European elections in June. It's probably subsided a bit in this campaign. It hasn't come up as much on the doorsteps. At least that's what, you know, some of the candidates are saying to me. And that might be because people are thinking about other issues, about housing in particular. It might be because the government has not done a huge amount on them. So in the lead up to the local and European elections, there were announcements about the opening of IPAS centres for asylum seekers. And there were a lot more events going around, and these were a kind of a theatre for protest. Those haven't been as obvious in this election campaign, but it hasn't gone away. The kind of extreme sort of ethno-nationalist parties that might normally benefit from this, they're possibly a bit too extreme. And so what you do find is that Ireland is unusual, again, in having a large number of independent candidates and a large number of independent TDs or MPs. And they tend to be the kind of vehicle through which migration issues get spoken about and get mentioned. Most of the parties, even from kind of nationalist Sinn Féin, they tended not to want to talk about it. All of the parties have been reluctant to kind of engage with migration as an issue. Media has been pretty reluctant to engage with it as an issue as well. And so that might be one of the reasons why we don't see or hear too much of it. But it could end up kind of surprising us on Friday or Saturday when people actually vote. If we do get a surprise, it might be because of migration.
I suppose in a sort of a European, you know, even a global landscape where we're seeing all these sort of seismic realignments of political dynamics all around us, many people might be looking at Ireland and sort of seeing it as a sort of a bulwark of stability at the moment. Do you think that's a fair narrative, or is it a little bit more complex?
We're seeing a lot of the same things that happen in the rest of Europe. We're seeing much more party fragmentation. We're seeing a lot of voter volatility. People are willing to change votes later. Campaign events seem to matter more than they would have in the past. It's possibly a bulwark of stability to some extent because we've had all this money. And so things like the cost of living crisis, when there were, you know, issues about energy bills, the government had the cash to literally pay some of our bills. So we got two checks for €400 twice a year. The government has been able to increase child benefit allowance and give us double payments for child benefit allowance, which ends up kind of helping with the costs of having kids and stuff. And so the government has been able to probably soften the blow of those cost of living crisis that maybe have fed more radical responses in other European countries. And then we don't see those here.
Eoin O'Malley is Associate Professor in Political Science at Dublin City University's School of Law and Government. Now, just time for
Germany's former Chancellor Angela Merkel has published her memoirs detailing her private life.
Yes, former Chancellor Angela Merkel has released her memoirs. They're titled Freedom, but what we want to know is, what was the nickname that the German people came to know their Chancellor by? Was it Engel or Angel? Mutti or Mummy? Chefin or Boss? And I think never has there been a more Freudian Inside Europe Spotify poll. That's the end of this section of the show. Coming up in the second half, which is available on our podcast feed if you're listening on a partner station which is leaving us here, a specially commissioned episode guest produced by environmental journalists Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor. That's here on Inside Europe, with them, but not with me. Bye.
Hot dust in the sky on a winter's day. Plastic bottles in the sea a thousand miles away. Acid rain from the clouds turned the trees to grey. Playing Russian roulette with our future. Vapor trails smoke the sky like a cigarette. Politicians ride the skies in a private jet. Seems they haven't realized the situation yet. Self-destruction is the etiquette. Thank you.
Hello from the United Kingdom, where we're recovering from the aftermath of another deadly storm. At least 5 people have been killed, and just like in so many places across Europe, hundreds of people's homes have been flooded. All this as the world makes sense of a new climate deal agreed at COP29.
No deal is better than a bad deal.
It has been a difficult journey, but we've delivered a deal.
Welcome to a special half-hour segment for Inside Europe from us, Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor. We're 2 environment journalists, and Kate has invited us to walk you through a significant week in the battle to save our planet. We come to you not from a studio, but outside, overlooking a national park as the storm subsides. It's one of the many places in Europe threatened by climate change. Coming up, we'll have all the reaction and analysis of what COP29 means.
It's very clear that this is totally insufficient. It's nowhere near where we want to be, and countries need to do significantly more.
Is COP even fit for purpose?
We have to change this. We have to get the fossil fuel lobby out. That has to stop.
And who can we trust to lead the fight against climate change?
Von der Leyen maybe is the best of a bad bunch.
As Spanish people come to terms with their floods...
It was really fast, like in 2 hours, it was like the water on my chest.
One project shows how communities can pull together to restore some of what's lost. But first, we turn to Storm Bert here in the UK, one of many extreme weather events made worse and more frequent by climate change. It was perhaps deeply symbolic that the storm did its worst, even as diplomats at COP struggled to reach a deal over the climate crisis. Dan takes a look at the week the world reckoned again with global heating.
A siren to say that the climate crisis is upon us. In a Yorkshire village, a World War II alarm blasts out. The emergency all these years later is not warfare, but oncoming floods. It could not have been more symbolic, ringing as the world haggled over a new climate deal at COP29, as if to say... Act now, because trouble is coming.
Now, British Gas is warning customers to stockpile food and water in the event of heavy snow as Storm Bert barrels towards the UK this weekend. This is in the Telegraph this morning. The storm allegedly is set to bring...
This weekend, it was the UK's turn to face the latest extreme weather. Storm Bert combines snowfall with fast-thawing floods and powerful winds. At least 5 people have drowned and landslides have cut off communities. 57 children had to be rescued from a flooded bus. And in an even more dramatic story, a father who couldn't swim had to pluck his newborn baby from his sinking car. They luckily survived. Wales was particularly badly hit, where a major incident has been declared.
Hi, Dan, it's Councillor Reid here.
Janine Reid was one of the thousands who went out to help her village.
The rain was just phenomenal. We've got a local sort of rugby club, Cross Keys. It was completely submerged in water. If you see the pictures, you know, it's just unbelievable how quick the waters rose, or the rivers rose, and they burst their banks. Risker Town Centre, the high street, it resembled a lake.
In the English town of Tenby Wells, residents yell "Get back!" as their high street turns into a river within minutes. For many, it's not the first time a flood has ruined lives. And as resident Mark Benbow tells me, people are losing patience.
The flood wall collapsed, which basically sent a tidal wave straight through the middle of Market Street. We've had this for many, many years. Really frustrating. Not much has been done. You know, this seems to be going around in circles a little bit.
Patience lost not just in the UK, but in Azerbaijan too. Even as Storm Bert tore apart homes, British and European officials were negotiating at COP29, the climate summit. It's partly because of the UK and EU's own climate costs that they and other rich countries were reluctant to pay more to help poorer countries. In the end, a $300 billion deal was done. That's what developed countries will pay the Global South each year, triple the current amount, as the UN's Climate Secretary, Simon Steele, announced.
It has been a difficult journey, but we've delivered a deal. This deal will keep the clean energy boom growing, helping all countries to share in its huge benefits. More jobs, stronger growth, cheaper and cleaner energy for all.
Developing countries wanted much more from richer nations, as India's representative Chandni Reynard laid bare.
Excellency, I regret to say that this document is nothing more than an optical illusion. This, in our opinion, will not address the enormity of the challenge we all face.
Their argument is simple and accepted. They did not cause the climate crisis, but they will suffer its worst impacts. Why then could rich nations not pay more of the $1.3 trillion required, they asked. Some screamed no deal was better than a bad one.
No deal is better than a bad deal. No deal is better than a bad deal. No deal is better than a bad deal.
Other protesters were even more visceral, vomiting green liquid in front of diplomats to show how COP has made them feel sick.
I'm sick! I'm sick of greenwash ethnic cleansing! I'm sick of European banks funding Azerbaijan's occupation of Armenian land under the guise of green hydrogen!
Once again, COP finds itself in the messy middle, delivering some progress, but nowhere near enough to avert catastrophes to come. Storm Bert in the UK, then, is both a warning and an answer to Europe. More must be done, or the coming storm will only grow bigger, and the siren shrieks will only get louder. So in the planet's moment of need, who can we rely on to inspire a way forward, particularly as the US is likely to step back under Donald Trump? Well, you may not have noticed it, but there's a leadership race underway and two names stand out. One, President von der Leyen of the EU, newly re-elected but promising to reform her continent's industries to make them greener and cleaner. And then there's the UK's Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who now presides over the greenest British Parliament in history. Can we rest our hopes on either or none? Lucy has this analysis.
Today is the start of a journey. But this is Europe's man on the moon moment.
The European Green President von der Leyen announcing a Green Deal so ambitious she compared it to the moon landings. It committed the EU to achieving net zero by 2050 and to restoring huge areas of nature, among many other eye-catching policies.
This goal, it's kind of 50 actions for 2050.
It was the world's first continent-wide package of climate laws and made von der Leyen a leader in the battle against the climate crisis. But oh, how times can change. 5 years later, after a pandemic and war in Europe, there's far more resistance to spending on green policies. That's the sound of farmers tooting their tractors in protest in Brussels, just one of many groups who want to slow von der Leyen down. The question is she caving?
Yeah, von der Leyen maybe is the best of a bad bunch.
That's Lorelei Lemazan, a climate campaigner from Greenpeace. They fear that von der Leyen is watering down policies for political expediency, like a flagship deforestation law that could be critical to wildlife.
And that law, von der Leyen just caved in and decided to postpone the implementation of the law. And now there's a really strong attack from some of the centre-right in the parliament and the far-right to weaken it even further.
The problem is, to meet the EU's goals, von der Leyen has to not only deliver action on the Green Deal, but go even further. As it stands, that's simply not happening quickly enough, with the EU on course to miss its 2030 emissions target by 12%. Worse still, it's reported the EU is going to miss the deadline to submit a new climate pledge to COP, which would surely undermine its leadership on the world stage.
And we urge all parties to come forward with ambitious targets of their own.
Enter the UK, fast becoming a new world leader in environmental politics. At this year's COP, its Prime Minister Keir Starmer promised to speed up the UK's race to net zero, one of only three countries to do so. Starmer's landslide victory this summer shifted the dial on British politics, with the left-wing Labour Party assuming office after 14 years of right-wing rule. Recent polling suggests the new parliament is the most pro-green in history. The UK is promising emissions cuts that would be in line with 1.5 degrees of global warming, the first country in the world to make such an ambitious pledge. But does action match the rhetoric?
This new announcement now needs to be translated into a tangible plan and a robust plan at home.
The charity Client Earth has taken the government to court twice and won, with judges deciding the UK was not decarbonising enough. Pierre Canet is one of their policy gurus, and he has worries that Starmer's new government might still not be ambitious enough.
We need to be very, very focused on the details of this plan, because we've seen some kind of bad signals in the past weeks regarding the budgets, for instance, where we see a lot of reliance on kind of false solutions to support false solutions like CCS, carbon capture and storage, which we find not as key solutions and a solution to not to prioritise in terms of emissions reductions.
There is then a bigger, even more fundamental question. Can we trust any of our leaders to match this vital hour with the required urgency? Perhaps the most damaging moment of COP29 was when the charity Global Witness secretly recorded the COP president's delegation trying to sell oil deals and promising that fossil fuels would last forever. CEO Mike Davis says we must ask why more than 1,000 fossil fuel lobbyists were present and demand more of our leaders to reform COP itself.
We can't have autocratic petrostates hosting these talks, using them to sell more oil and gas deals. We can't have a pinstripe army of fossil fuel lobbyists in every time, right in the negotiations on occasions as part of national delegations to sabotage things. Our view is that there is still a merit in trying to reform the COP process that is contingent on the heads of governments which actually show up and are responsible for making the decisions we need. They have to step up and say, okay, that's it. We have to change this. We have to get the fossil fuel lobby out. That has to stop.
In the end, Keir Starmer and President von der Leyen may be ambitious compared to others, but many campaigners think they're still not ambitious enough, not matching their high words with fast enough action. The world has watched 29 COP summits go by, and emissions are still not falling.
So, to the most urgent question of all, after all these climate summits, how bad will this crisis get? In a moment, you'll be hearing from one of the world's leading UN scientists on climate change and an author on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But first, we thought it's worth recapping what each degree of global warming really means.
Remember, violent hurricanes, wildfires, floods, droughts, extinctions and deaths all get worse every fraction of a degree the planet gets hotter. But we've been through different scientific opinions to give you a sense of what happens at each degree rise in the worst cases. These are, of course, just models. There's a lot of variability. But to give you a better sense, at 1.5 degrees, we'll see some islands and coastal cities flooded and most coral reefs go extinct.
If we pass 2 degrees, many of the world's biggest coastal cities will be inundated with seawater, coral reefs will disappear, and 30 million more people in Europe will face water scarcity.
At 3 degrees, over centuries, many great European cities would be wiped out with water. We'd lose Amsterdam, Hamburg, Venice, and many others. 1 billion people could be displaced, and we'd likely lose 1/4 of all species. Based on action only and not pledges, that's where we're currently headed.
And it could get worse. At 4 degrees, the majority of the planet could not host wildlife.
Above 5 degrees, it's estimated the human population drops to 1 billion and most of the world becomes uninhabitable.
So, deep breath. Where is the world currently headed? I spoke to Nicholas Hoerner, a climate scientist who's on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and founder of the new Climate Institute in Cologne. He created the Climate Action Tracker. It's used at COP and it's used by governments, and it tracks actions and commitments on climate change. And I started by asking him whether he's seeing any progress.
Yeah, we look at actions each year, and you can definitely see that more and more activities are happening, mainly in the area of renewable energy. Renewable energy is surprising us each year that it's going faster and that it's even cheaper. We also see at the same time that many countries are expanding their fossil fuel infrastructure still and still increase their energy use. And that is a problem. And these two trends are canceling each other out. And in total, we see that global emissions are stable. They're not increasing anymore as they used to in the past, but they're also not decreasing and they're basically stable.
And what about President Trump? Let's say he starts to roll back some policies. What impact will that have on total global heating?
Well, US's greenhouse gas emissions are declining under the Biden administration with new policies. And if Trump would roll back some of these policies, they would still be declining, maybe a little bit less, but they would still be declining because Trump can't undo market forces. Renewables are also cheap in the US. If we take that as an effect and calculate the temperature by the end of the century, it will be very, very minimal, the difference between the two scenarios, 0.04 degrees. That's within the uncertainty and almost not measurable. The big fear was that it has a knock-on effect on other countries, that if US moves out of the Paris Agreement, then other countries would follow. But that big fear is not materialized. No other country has said that they move the Paris Agreement. So the agreement is stable and will continue as it is.
I think with how we know President Trump is going to go, the big question now is who's going to step up and provide the leadership if it's not America?
Now that the US is likely to leave the Paris Agreement, there's a big gap for leadership and some countries need to fill it. Prime candidate is the UK right now. They're agile. They have a new government. They have provided a new national climate target for 2035. So that's really good. And second on the list is the EU, which is also very committed to climate policy, has the Green Deal and now the Industrial Deal. It's not called climate anymore. It's more called industrial policy. But in effect, it's the same thing because it's about future and about innovation. And then the most surprising positive one for me was China. China was very constructive in the climate negotiations, really moved forward, showed views of compromise, and really has an interest in the Paris Agreement being successful. And that is also because China is the powerhouse of the energy transition. Everything that countries need for the transition comes from China, and that's why China has a big interest in making this work.
So now COP's come to an end. Do you think this COP29 will be seen as a success?
There's always a split view on the success of this conference. On the positive side, it's, I think, very good that there has been an agreement at all, because it's a sign of cooperation in a very diverging world. It's very good to see that countries come together, that they take climate seriously, and that they can, by consensus, agree that this is important and that they want to take a next step. On the negative side, it's very clear that this is totally insufficient. The amount of money on the table is far too little, and the most vulnerable countries are rightfully so angry and disappointed that that is not enough. And also on the level of proposed emission reductions, it's nowhere near where we want to be, and countries need to do significantly more.
You've got decades of experience in this area. Have you become more optimistic, or do you remain deeply cynical? Where do you sit on the climate personally?
Oh, well, it's always half and half. I'm still hopeful because our outlook has improved significantly. Only 10 years ago, we thought that we're heading towards 3.5 degrees, which would be totally catastrophic. And now we know with everything that countries are doing, we're heading more to 2.7 degrees. That's almost a degree better than only 10 years ago. And I think that's the floor. So it will be maximum 2.7, because now countries are really saying we want to move away from coal, oil and gas, we want to reach zero. And if they implement all of their promises, then we would reach 1.9 degrees, which is 1.5 degrees better than 10 years ago. 1.9 is still not good and there will be severe damages, but the outlook is much, much better. And I think we are more heading in the direction of two now then in the direction of 3 or 4, which only was the case 10 years ago. So I'm hopeful that we can do this, and there is progress. On the other hand, well, these are our projections for the future. This still has to materialize, and there are still a lot of obstacles on the way that we need to solve.
So 2.7 degrees Celsius, that's where he says we're currently headed. But the number should keep getting lower if our leaders step up. After the break, we'll give you a snapshot of one community that's pulling together against climate change and take a broader look at this 50-year fight to save the planet. See you soon.
Poison in the water, poison in the rain. Poison in the water, but still the fact remains. You deny it ever happened, deny it ever will. Deny it ever happened, but it keeps on happening still.
Now to Spain, where work has started in rebuilding the towns and areas damaged by this month's extreme flooding. There have been so many losses, but one positive story has emerged amid the wreckage. The restoration department of the Museum of Valencia has joined forces with a project called Save the Photos. They've asked families to bring into the museum any albums that were damaged by floodwater and are using their technical expertise to bring those photos back. It's a way of salvaging memories and showing that communities can pull together, as Ashi Sharma reports.
Weeks after the Dana, heavy rain once again beats a somber drum on the streets of Valencia, where I'm standing right now. While talk of the rebuilding work has focused on the physical, buildings, transport, infrastructure, the Save the Photos project is altogether more emotional, personal. A celluloid salvation of memories for people like Marta from the town of Paiporta, which was at the epicentre of the flooding and damage.
Now I've been like 3 years living in my grandma's house. I live there alone. I was there when the flood came, so it was really fast. Like in 2 hours, it was like the water on my chest, and I've lost almost everything. I've saved some things, but the whole house is like, is everything covered, how do you say that? Mud, with mud, yeah.
Well, I've just walked into the, the centre of operations. This is the room where all the work of restoring these photos, which are memories of people's lives. You've got clothes rack there with pegs with photos on them. There are fans that I suppose are drying all the images. And the person that's in charge of all of this is joining me now.
My name is Rosina Herrera, and I'm one of the volunteers here helping. I'm a photograph conservator. This initiative is working thanks to the efforts of the 5 public universities in Valencia, plus the Ethnologic Museum and the Spanish group of the International Institute for Conservation. So here what we are doing is collecting the photographs of these families affected by Dana and trying to rescue them. And the first steps are washing to remove all the dirt and fungi or whatever we have from the after the disaster, and drying. So that's why we are hanging the photographs or leaving them flat so they can be dry and making groups.
Some of these photos, like here, you've got some images of families together, laughing, having dinner, which is very personal, but they look quite okay. And then next to them, there are photos which are completely, that look to me completely destroyed with water. I mean, can these photos be saved?
These two buckets are, they are just here because we don't feel like throwing them away, but we cannot do anything with this. All the colorants, all the emulsion is gone, and the difference are that these were in albums, and these were loose in a box of shoes or whatever. So when they are loose, they are more affected by water. When they are in the album, they were protected by the plastic. And even though it's risky because the plastic can be stuck together and it's hard to remove it, it's working pretty well. One of my colleagues here, Asia, she's actually pulling the plastic from the photograph, yeah. And we are not having bigger, it's not that
It's working so far. We don't have many, many problems.
No la más afectada, que es pasando el puente desde Valencia.
Marta is one of many thousands of people who've responded to the call. The photos are more precious as they pre-age the digital era of cameras, smartphones and cloud storage space. The moments caught in these images are the only ones that exist. There is no backup.
There are the albums of my grandma and my grandfather. They were there like a treasure. There are photos where they were younger when they bought the business. My uncle was young and he was starting this business with my grandfather.
You've got all those photos as a memory, haven't you?
Yeah. The albums were closed, obviously, and they got wet. If I open them, the water makes like the ink run. I think they are going to be saved, but they need to be dry. And I don't know how to do that.
We get also some other things, like family treasures, like a, I don't know, like an ID card. These are paperwork about the property of the house. There are also notes, money, here, drawing. So the goal is mainly photographs, but we are receiving a mix of everything.
So successful has the response been that the museum has now set up centres in all the affected areas for people to drop off their albums locally. The restorers say, given the numbers of photos they've already received, this project will last many more months. But they are determined to give back some happiness to families who've lost virtually everything. Ashish Sharma, DW Valencia.
So we're reaching the end of this special programme, but we wanted to just end with some of our own reflections. Dan, we've been covering environment stories now for a decade. How do you feel about the future of the climate?
I mean, those interviews we've done, you kind of have moments where you feel really scary when you hear 2.7 degrees Celsius and understand what that means. But I want to end on a sort of positive thought. You know, the world still keeps trying to come together. We are still talking to each other. We are still making some deals. So there is some progress, I guess, but yeah, you know, scary times if we don't do more.
Okay, and on that thought, it's thank you and farewell from us. Kate will be back next week with the latest stories affecting Europe, but we're going to leave you with something a little different, a montage of some of the most dramatic moments in the history of this great planetary story. A story, of course, that's still being written. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our harvests are failing. Our animals and people are dying.
Wildfires that are sweeping through Australia. 30,000 people ordered to evacuate.
We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you can talk about is money. How dare you?
Drastic efforts are underway in Cape Town, South Africa, to prevent the city from running out of water.
The people alive now will look at this conference and consider one thing. Did that number stop rising?
We will drill, baby, drill.
Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah.
We do not
blah.
Want that dreaded death sentence. And we've come here today to say, try harder, try harder.
You are the last best hope of Earth. We ask you to protect it, for we and all living things we cherish are history.
Thanks to Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor for that post-COP special. My thanks this week also go to sound engineers Jürgen Kuhn and Thomas Schmidt. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.